Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we celebrate Independence Day by bringing back Matthew Dennis for another of his several visits with us over the course of the year to discuss the history of the nation's civic holidays. Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon, is the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. Following my conversation with Matthew Dennis, Max Skidmore will join us to comment on the lives of American presidents after they leave office, and Kelly Schrum will introduce you to our site of the week, this one dealing with the nation's first president, George Washington. But first, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. In my introduction, I made reference to George Washington as the nation's first president, and most would agree, but not Bill Stanley of Norwich, Connecticut. Stanley claims that Samuel Huntington was the first president, and he's seeking $10 million to restore the Huntington home to a presidential library. For the record, Huntington was the first of nine presidents to serve under the Articles of Confederation, the nation's first constitution, which was adopted soon after Americans declared their independence, but replaced by our current Constitution in 1789. Huntington signed the Declaration of Independence and served as Connecticut governor from 1786 until his death in 1796. And what about Washington's claim to fame? "The facts are on our side," Stanley commented. "The first president came from Norwich, and we should have a presidential library. George Washington is the father of our country. He's the greatest American who ever lived, and he's the 11th president. What's wrong with that?" And July 4th is an important anniversary for events other than the Declaration of American Independence. In a recently published article in the Virginia Quarterly Review, Ted Genoways reminds us that this July 4th is also the 150th anniversary of the publication of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Whitman is one of the nation's best-known poets, and with his Leaves of Grass, Genoways writes, "Not only American poetry, but also the American artistic stance was born." Whitman's volume of poetry was not readily embraced. Its novel free verse was difficult to understand. The poems had no individual titles, and the author was unnamed. Nevertheless, readers recognized it as something new, and soon, something American. One of its reviewers wrote, "It's like no other book that ever was written, and therefore the language usually employed in notices of new publications is unavailable in describing it." And therein lies the real significance of Leaves of Grass, Genoways continues. Whitman did more than invent a new mode of poetry. He created something that required a new language to describe, a new way of thinking to encompass it. That was difficult for Whitman's contemporary readers to accept, but, concludes Genoways, that made the publication all the more important. July 4th, 1855 was the magic birth of more than Walt Whitman. It was also the moment of our own immaculate conception when a poet imagined us into being. In the expanded edition published the following year, Whitman wrote, "It avails not, neither time or place. Distance avails not. I am with you, you men and women of a generation or ever so many generations hence." And indeed he is. In a moment, Matthew Dennis and I discuss the history of Independence Day. This is Talking History. With me this week for another in our year-long look at the history of the nation's major civic holidays is Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. Some of you will recall our earlier conversations on Martin Luther King Day, President's Day, and Memorial Day. This week we celebrate the oldest and perhaps the most venerable of American civic celebrations, Independence Day. Welcome back, Matthew.
Good to be with you.
It may seem like a silly question to many of our readers, but let's take a moment and just ask, what are we celebrating on Independence Day on July 4th?
Is this a trick question, like who's buried in Grant's tomb?
Well, it's only a trick because I know the answer, but go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, to state maybe the obvious, Independence Day, or the 4th of July, is by definition America's oldest public holiday. It marks the day on July 4th, 1776, when the Congress declared the independence of the new United States from Great Britain during the American Revolution. And so it's that day on which that grand separation was proclaimed.
Now, John Adams made the case, though, it should have been July 2nd, and that's why I asked the question.
Right. Well, Congress did resolve to declare, but they actually made that declaration on July 4th. And what's really important about this, in a way, is not what Congress did, but what the people did, because the declaration actually wouldn't mean very much if, in fact, the rest of the revolution hadn't occurred and if the people hadn't then properly proclaimed it. So, in a way, then, what makes the declaration what it is and what makes this holiday what it is that popular acclamation of the publication of the declaration. By publication, we mean not just putting it in print, but actually making it public, in a sense, sending it up the flagpole and see if anyone salutes.
Well, let me pursue that just a step further, because you may or may not agree with those historians that have tried to suggest that it was really July 2nd that mattered. And I should bracket this by saying they're looking at in the context of the time. Someone like Pauline Muir, for example, says that the actual declaration was on the 2nd and the document later was intended to explain it, but it wasn't terribly important, although she would agree with your statement about it was really the war that mattered, but that later on it was the declaration that became more important, meaning the written document. How would you respond to that?
It's certainly true that Congress officially resolved to declare independence on July 2nd. And if we think about that act as a separation from Great Britain, and we think about the Declaration of Independence that was ultimately disseminated as having one chief function, and that was to sever that relationship, then certainly July the 2nd becomes very important. To my way of thinking, though, July the 4th is the most important date because it's the date on which Congress officially resolved to declare independence and began the process of publication. And by publication, we mean not just putting it in print, but actually making it public so it would be proclaimed far and wide, read to troops, read to throngs of citizens. And it was their act of accepting it, of proclaiming it, that actually made it important. Because if it wasn't the people of the country itself who resolved to actually follow through and make good on the declaration, then it wouldn't have gone anywhere. So in that case, the declaration becomes an important, not just a text, but an actual action. And it's transformative, and it's transformative through people's action in the same way that words uttered by an umpire at a baseball game, you're out. That changes things. That has effects. And that's what the population at large was doing when they helped to proclaim the document. So that's why I see July 4th as more important.
And I think most would agree with you, and that's certainly the good transition to your research. So let's look at the holiday itself. And in your introduction, you write, Independence Days have their standard formulas, but the festival is as essentially local as it is national. Now, that comes as a bit of a surprise because most of us consider Independence Day a national holiday, and here you're suggesting there's a large element of locality involved.
Yeah, well, as the famous House of Representatives figure in the late 20th century, Tip O'Neill, said, all politics is local. And what we see in Independence Day, as in so many other things, people act locally even when they imagine what they're doing, and what they are doing has a national impact or implications. So in places all across the country, we see these small Independence Day festivals, parades, picnics, orations, and so forth. And it's people acting locally in their capacity as citizens of the nation. And so what we see then is the kind of projection of their particular way of being America on the rest of the country. So that even something like sectionalism or sectional identity becomes a way of saying, look, the way I am living, say, in the South or in the East is the way to be an American. And if others don't agree or if others express different interests, they're being, in a way, less authentically American than I am. So it's a kind of looking out from individual and community and regional perspective sometimes towards the nation and understanding it in really local, immediate terms.
Okay, good point. Let me take you back to the first Independence Day celebrations. You write, when Americans declared their independence in 1776, they committed a revolutionary act. And throughout the war for independence, their commemoration of that event served the partisan goals of their revolutionary party. What does that mean?
Well, you know, in a way, what Americans were doing was indulging in some wishful thinking. The Declaration said that the ties with Great Britain were severed. But that wouldn't really mean anything unless the revolution was actually fought and won, the Treaty of Paris ultimately was signed, and so forth. And so, in a way, then, the celebration of Independence Day was a way of really cultivating a certain political program, that is, the program of the patriots or the rebels. Once the war was won and the new governments were established, then Independence Day continued to reflect a particular political position, especially of the Federalists. And so even during the time of the debates over the Constitution, the 4th of July, Independence Day celebrations were actually used as lobbying events for ratification of the Constitution itself. So it had this kind of effect of celebrating America into existence.
And did that change after, let's say, take it from the period when the Constitution was ratified up to the Civil War?
Well, yeah, it did. We see by the time of the Constitution, it was a Federalist holiday. We see the emergence of a two-party system pretty early in the nation's history, where we see the Federalist on the one hand and Democratic Republicans on the other, the party of Jefferson. Especially by the 1790s and after the election of 1800, when Jefferson was elected, then the 4th of July became a Democratic-Republican holiday, celebrating the nation, of course, but also the document, the Declaration of Independence, one of the most sacred texts in American history, and its principal author, Thomas Jefferson. So the day becomes a Democratic-Republican holiday and filled with all sorts of implications, based especially on the early parts of the document, which has these really radical words that all men are created equal. So it becomes a kind of an invitation and provocation for Americans to claim a full measure of equality within the United States. And so in a way, then, the Declaration of Independence, its meaning changes, the holiday changes, and makes that sacred date, July 4th, available for all sorts of political agitation.
I want to come back to talk about two particular groups that seized on those revolutionary words or radical words. But before I get there, the Civil War poses a particular challenge to the celebration of American independence. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, if I can go back to those words in the Declaration, that all men are created equal, then the potential to see the Declaration of Independence as an anti-slavery document were huge. And that's, in fact, what happened. And so, in many ways, then, the South would have a very different interpretation of the day and of the document that stood behind it. If the Civil War was about slavery, of course it was also, as the most devastating event in American history, a time when the Union itself was torn apart. And the 4th of July is about the Union. It's about nationalism. It's about the construction of a nation and a people. And so with the Civil War, when that was ripped asunder, what would be the meaning of Independence Day thereafter? In the immediate aftermath, what we see in many ways is a kind of rejection, at least by many white Southerners, of the day as a significant day worth celebrating. Of course, they wouldn't necessarily take responsibility for causing the war, and they wouldn't want to celebrate it in the same way that Unionists would in the North. So in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, in many ways, it became a black celebration, an African-American holiday of liberation in the South, while many whites stayed more or less in a kind of somber mode.
You made reference to the anti-slavery movement using the 4th of July or Independence Day to their purposes. Did they actually use the document itself to their ends?
Absolutely. For one thing, they would stage their events often on the 4th of July. And they would use the Declaration of Independence as their sacred text, in some cases going so far, especially among radical abolitionists, going so far as to reject the Constitution. They called it a covenant with the devil, or a corrupt document because it accepted slavery within the structure of the government. So they would use it and proclaim the passages that talked about equality.
Now, the most direct reference that I recall in my limited knowledge of the subject, of course, is the use at Seneca Falls of the Declaration of Independence by a woman suffrage movement.
Yeah, and as I said, it was a provocation and an invitation for various Americans to claim the rights promised, or they would argue were promised to them in the Declaration. And so what we see at Seneca Falls in 1848, for example, is a paraphrasing or rephrasing of the Declaration so that it's not just all men are created equal, but all men and women are created equal. And so it's a call of conscience and an effort to broaden the dimensions of liberty and equality as guaranteed, they would argue, in the Declaration of Independence. And then it would be continued to use that way throughout the 19th century. By 1876, for example, the National Woman Suffrage Association would issue a new Declaration of Independence. And we see throughout the history of the United States redeclarations, using the words, sometimes paraphrasing them, shifting them a little, to expand the realm of liberty and equality.
Right. And I think this is a good example of what I was referring to earlier, where other historians have really come down on the side of this document was probably more important than the actual vote for independence, in that it's a document that will be continually reused by every cause that wishes to seek independence or equality in America.
Absolutely, and it's an irony that it has no legal standing. It did its job in 1776, but it has this ongoing sacred quality in articulating American values and principles.
Okay, we only have a couple minutes left, but let's take it up to the present, and maybe you can deal with the history from essentially the Vietnam War, which is another challenge, up to the present. What's happened to American Independence Day in contemporary America?
Well, we know that there's always a potential for it to be used to criticize or to measure the United States against its ideals, especially those articulated in the Declaration. It's also just a holiday. It's the nation's birthday, a time for celebration. And often, at a birthday, we don't necessarily critique the birthday boy, the birthday girl. You know, we just celebrate. And a lot of that happened, especially as Americans achieved greater prosperity and security. But it always had and continues to have this potential for criticism. In 1976, Ron Kovic published a book called Born on the 4th of July. And in that book, he offers a searing indictment of America's involvement in Vietnam. And he brings up the fact that he was born on the 4th of July itself and really embraced all the values of America and then saw them shattered in his own Vietnam experience, metaphorically but also literally, as he became disabled during his service. And so it was a time when he, like so many other Americans, questioned the course of American foreign policy, but also society more generally. Since that time, I haven't noticed the holiday used in quite that way. We've seen a series, I think, over the last 30 years or so, of generic celebrations that seem to be merely celebratory, mindless in some ways, frivolous. And, you know, that's okay. That's what birthdays can be about. But as I said, only time will tell whether a new sorts of crises will emerge that will invite Americans to use the day as a time to really question the direction of the United States and the realization of its values and principles.
Well, your work and certainly the history that I've read suggested that in fact will happen, but you're right, we'll have to see. So thank you, Matt, for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Okay, looking forward to getting you back to talk about Labor Day, the next American holiday in our series. I've been speaking with Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. This is Talking History. George Washington left the presidency in 1797, retired to his home, Mount Vernon, and died 2 years later. Not so for all the presidents that followed him. Some went on to even more distinguished careers after their years in the White House. Max Skidmore has looked at the life of the nation's presidents and is here to offer us a summary of what he found. Skidmore, Curator's Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, is the author of After the White House, Former Presidents as Private Citizens, published by Palgrave Macmillan Press.
Former presidents sometimes become obscure despite their expertise and wealth of experience. The political system provides no formal role for them, but most remain active as well they should. Many, in fact, still exercise influence. Some even seek another office. Two return to Congress. John Quincy Adams spent a lengthy and distinguished career in the House of Representatives. The impeached Andrew Johnson took a seat in the Senate, serving briefly before dying. John Tyler also became a legislator, but one dedicated to overthrowing the Constitution of the country that he had led. He served in the Provisional Congress of the Confederacy. He was elected to the Confederate House of Representatives, but died before he could take his seat. Only one president has served on the Supreme Court. Ex-President William Howard Taft accepted the Kent Chair of Law at Yale, although the heaviest man ever to be president joked that a sofa of law would be a better fit. Later, President Harding fulfilled Taft's lifelong ambition by appointing him Chief Justice. Four presidents sought to regain the office, and one actually succeeded. Martin Van Buren came back in 1848 to run on the Free Soil Party's ticket. In 1856, Millard Fillmore accepted the bigoted Know-Nothing Party's nomination. Theodore Roosevelt ran again in 1912 as the progressive Bull Moose candidate, coming in second. The winner was Grover Cleveland. He lost to Benjamin Harrison in 1888, and his wife Frances said they would be back in 4 years. They were. Cleveland became the only president to serve non-consecutive terms. Jefferson, Jackson, Eisenhower, and others gave advice as elder statesmen to their successors. Many produced memoirs and biographies. Van Buren, Buchanan, Coolidge, Hoover, Truman, Eisenhower, LBJ, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and the first Bush did so. Theodore Roosevelt's autobiography is especially valuable, and Grant's memoirs are a masterful contribution to American letters. Herbert Hoover has the distinction of being the only president to write a biography of a former president, Woodrow Wilson. Carter stands out for his civic and humanitarian activities, and Clinton is following in his footsteps. Carter won the Nobel Prize for Peace, the third president, along with Theodore Roosevelt and Wilson, to do so. He and Ford cooperate vigorously to combat political and religious extremism. Time precludes a discussion of them all, but most presidents continued their contributions to their country after they left office.
You've been listening to Max Skidmore, Curator's Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of After the White House, Former Presidents as Private Citizens. Finally, following on our repeated references this week to George Washington, Kelly Shrum returns to Talking History to tell us about a new site where you can learn more about the nation's first, or was he the 11th, President of the United States. Shrum is Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
In his last will and testament, George Washington freed his slaves. Upon the decease of my wife, it is my will and desire that all the slaves which I hold in my own right shall receive their freedom. And to my mulatto man William, I give immediate freedom, as a testimony of my sense of his attachment to me, and for his faithful services during the Revolutionary War. This site introduces users to the life of George Washington. A 4,000-word introductory essay on Washington's life and career reflects current scholarship. The timeline is a chronology of the milestones in his life, with a few references to national events. The multimedia room includes 11 audio clips of scholars discussing Washington's importance in the second half of the 18th century. There are also 4 sound files of Pat Sajak reading memorial letters written by Thomas Jefferson and Winston Churchill, among others, and 5 video clips of Charlton Heston reading some of Washington's more famous letters and speeches, such as his farewell speech. The site contains a modest collection of 150 Washington letters and Washington's Book of Etiquette, which he copied when he was 16 years old. The letters are divided into pre-revolutionary, revolutionary, pre-presidential, presidential, and post-presidential collections, and include personal letters from and to Washington and his wife, as well as other documents such as presidential pardons, indenture documents, and land surveys. Teachers will find useful the 10 detailed high school lesson plans that include bibliographies. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Rediscovering George into the keyword search.
Sound, sound the trump of fame. Let Washington's great name ring through the world with loud applause. Ring through the world with loud applause. Let every clime to freedom dear listen with a joyful ear. With equal skill and godlike power, he governs in the fearful hour of horrid war, or guides with ease the happier times of honest peace. Then united let us be, rallying round our liberty, as a band of brothers joined, peace and safety we shall find.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed our celebration of Independence Day. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. And that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.